Sådär ja, jag och Victor sitter här på Bench och har precis intervjuat Colin Trevorrow som har regisserat Safety Not Guaranteed som visas här på filmfestivalen. Så ni ska få lyssna lite på det. Och vi ber om ursäkt om det är lite dåligt ljud eller om mitt uttal och min nervositet förstör lite av upplevelsen.
Det är Patrik som för det mesta sköter den här intervjun. Jag har några frågor sen senare mot slutet och min engelska är inte heller helt fantastisk.
Det rullar bättre än mitt uttal.
Okej, det gör det kanske. Men, och som ni vet så jag har ju snackat om Safety Not Guaranteed lite i podcasten innan och det är verkligen jag älskar verkligen den här filmen, så det var helt underbart att få träffa Colin Trevorrow då, mannen bakom den här filmen.
Ja, sjukt härlig snubbe också.
Ja, verkligen otroligt.
Som ni kommer att höra.
Ja, så att han är alltså riktigt riktigt skön, alltså typisk amerikansk snubbe liksom, verkligen. Jag gillar honom jättemycket. Så det var verkligen roligt att få intervjua honom. Så enjoy helt enkelt.
Ja, då kör vi.
So we're sitting here with Colin Trevorrow, who has directed the movie Safety Not Guaranteed, which is showing here at the Stockholm Film Festival. I wanted to ask you, is this your first time in Sweden?
Yes, it is my first time.
Yeah. How do you like it?
I love it, I love it. It's a beautiful city. I've been to a lot of places in Europe, so it's not just like the only European city I've ever seen, and therefore it's beautiful. It's pretty incredible. I think they're better at mixing the old architecture and the new architecture here than in any European city I've seen.
Yeah.
It's pretty seamless.
Okay. What have you been doing so far since you arrived?
We walked around and had a great meal, and I want to go to the market today. I try to go to the market like in every town I go to, because I feel like it's the best way to understand any city. We showed the movie yesterday and had a Q&A. And
yeah, how was that?
It was great. It was great.
Big audience.
It was a big audience. Yeah, it was full. Not as many questions, but I think that can oftentimes, like, it's kind of a cultural thing. Like, sometimes people don't necessarily...
Swedes are normally quite, how do you say?
Yeah, they stick to themselves, kind of.
Yeah.
Like, exposed to the chest.
Yeah.
Not like us, but I think the general audience in Sweden is, like, very...
Very buttoned down,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, very shy.
Yeah, very shy.
Not really afraid to kind of take space...
Yeah, that's.
We're afraid of.
I don't ask questions in Q&As either. So,
okay.
I get it.
So, Safety Not Guaranteed. It's your first full-length feature film.
Mm-hmm.
How does it feel having your baby out in the world and doing stuff like this, traveling over the world on festivals and talking about the film and watching people seeing the film and getting response and such?
It feels great. I mean, you know, she's not really a baby anymore. Like, there was, at Sundance she was a baby, and then like over the summer she was, you know, a child. Now she's like a teenager. She's a total slut. She's everywhere. And so I'm kind of used to it. And so, you know, I feel like I'll never get, is this going to be, should we tell these guys?
I don't think it's going
to
be a problem.
All right, just for people listening to the podcast, we're in like a club that's been that was open till 6 a.m. and it's a cool vibe. Like, you know, wish you were here, but you can smell the vomit on the floor. And, I've been traveling a lot to a lot of cities with it, a lot of different countries, and people react slightly differently everywhere, and I never really get sick of. Watching it with people, because it's kind of like time travel for me. Like, I just get to go back and live, you know, in that experience of making the film, which was a great part of my life, a great time, and so I don't know if I'll ever get bored with it.
Was Sundance the premiere of the film?
Yeah.
And how has the life been since you've traveled around the world since then? But
yeah, that's right. I mean, you know,
how has the reception of the movie changed?
It's been great. Like, it hasn't changed, like, my life, like, as a daily, you know, I still, you know, need to take out the garbage every day. Like, you know, I live in Vermont, and I have a pretty non-Hollywood, you know, lifestyle. So that hasn't changed, but, you know, what
maybe
has...
it's going to change soon.
Yeah, we'll see, we'll see. You know, what has changed is, you know, being a filmmaker and a writer, you're just constantly asking people to trust you.
Yeah.
And I feel like... You know, the level of trust that I get right off the bat has increased, which is really the main goal.
Yeah, all right. The movie is based on a sort of urban legend of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real ad about the person who wants someone to travel back in time. Or
You think we should go in here?
Okay, let's go in here. Yeah, this is gonna. I don't want to ruin this whole thing.
The film is based on a sort of urban legend, a real ad posted by a person who wanted someone to travel back in time with him. When did you first hear about this, and what was the process that led you to make a movie out of it?
Well, I can't take credit for it. It was Derek Connolly who wrote the screenplay, who's my writing partner, and it was at a time when the two of us, we've always written together, and we were writing scripts for various Hollywood studios and getting hired for rewrites and assignments and things like that, and it was at a time when the in thing to do was to make films based on products like Battleship, board games, yeah, things like that, and so we went to our agents and they were like, look, like, you know, you can't write an original story, like, just go to Walmart, go to the toy store and walk down through the aisles and look at products and then write a movie about one of those products. And we were just like, fuck you guys. We got really depressed, and so Derek, in his way, saw this ad, and it's something that he'd seen a bunch of times and was really into, and it had been around for, you know, 10 years almost, and he sort of calculated, well, you know, this has a brand awareness in a certain way amongst people on the internet, people who I think are cool and that I want to make a movie for, and so this is our, you know, that was his version of Battleship, was to, yeah, to take that brand awareness and build a story out of this meme.
Okay, cool. Even though your film focuses on very different things, there's still some discussion about time travel. How did you prepare for that, and what were your inspirations?
I think, like, my inspirations were just my mistakes, you know, in life. And I think that, you know, I think all of us wish we had a time machine, like, on a weekly basis, and sometimes even a daily basis. Like, if you could just be, hey, if I could change, like, this, and this, like, this day would have been exactly the way I wanted it to be. And that was something that we didn't feel had been addressed in time travel movies as much as we would want it to. Oftentimes, you either see some kind of, like, you know, giant world shattering stakes, or in the case of Back to the Future, you know, enormous personal stakes. Yeah. But this was a way to really focus on very specific emotional stakes with one person, and, you know, no one's going to live or die necessarily if they don't go and fix these things, but, you know, their life will be on the path that they would prefer, and so we really focus on that, and, you know, on like the emotional needs that time travel satisfies in all of us, and, you know, why we need that time machine, and that's really what led the movie to end up, you know, resting on the themes that it does. Is that Derek and I just, you know, made a ton of mistakes.
Yeah. It's really fussy sometimes creating discussing time travel artwork and such. Have you seen Looper?
Sure. No, I haven't seen Looper yet. I said sure because I've seen, like, all the other time travel movies. Of course I've seen a time travel movie. I haven't, and I look forward to it. We have the same distributor, actually, Ryan and I, the two of us got to have dinner in Spain, and neither of us had seen each other's movie, but we are like the twin time travel movies of yeah. Film District this year, and I've heard nothing but incredible things. And what specifically about? Yeah, I know the time travel rules in that are bananas.
Yeah, I just wanted to hear your opinion or what you thought about the movie in general.
Yeah,
if you haven't seen it, then.
It's also kind of an indie time travel thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're kind of siblings in some ways.
The only difference is they had 29 million more than we did to make that movie. But
how big budget did you have?
It was $750,000. So probably, yeah, like the cost of Joseph Gordon-Levitt's, like, trailer and M&M's. But
probably. I read that Aubrey Plaza's character was written for a because of your script writer and friend, Derek Connolly, wanted to work with her, and that Jake Johnson was a choice by you because you wanted to work with him. Why did you want to work with him, and was it difficult getting the actors in the movie?
It wasn't, and actually everybody in this movie was just because I think they're great. I mean, it's a very almost erratic collection of people, and, like, you don't necessarily think you're going to see Jeff Garlin and Kristen Bell and Marilyn Ricecup and all these people in the same movie, and these are just people that I think are hilarious. And you know, I knew that a movie like this, you know, of this scope and scale is going to rest on the performances of the actors, that we don't really have much else to show off but our story and our characters. And I felt like, you know, this was also an opportunity that I may not ever have again to cast actors just because I think they're great, and not necessarily because, you know, they have foreign sales value and all the other things you have to take into consideration when you're budgeting out a movie and choosing people. So I just really embraced that, and I, you know, I knew we were telling a story that started with unlikable characters, which is not something that you really are going to even be able to do in bigger budget films, and yet I knew that each of these people are inherently likable, you know, beneath that surface, you know, that we character that we all know. So I felt like each of them were a great way to start, you know, in one place and really, really take a journey to somewhere else emotionally.
That's in Looper. There's also some. You don't really feel sympathy for everyone, or the sympathy changes over the course of the film for every character. And that's one more similarity.
It's probably because it's a good movie. I mean, I think that's, you know, that's something that I think we've really, we just don't do it as much anymore. And it seems like, you know, movies, you know, 20 and 30 years ago, you really had people who were actually deeply flawed. And now I feel like most characters, you know, yeah, they have a problem and they have something that you want them to fix, and you know, you want them to need and all that kind of stuff, but you very rarely get to start with somebody who's just has real serious problems to the point of being a deeply imperfect and almost unlikable person and goes all the way to being your hero. Like, they often just sort of start as the hero with a little bit of extra baggage, hero with a drinking problem.
Yeah.
You know?
I read that some scenes in the film were improvised. Is that correct?
It's more that elements within scenes were improvised. Okay. Every scene that's there was written in some form, and you know what we did do is we would always shoot what was written, and then if I felt or if the actors felt like we didn't have a complete scene, you know, sometimes, you know, we realized that we'd earned a little bit more, and maybe we had the A and the B, but we didn't have the C of that scene, and so if ever that happened, we would make sure to you know, stay in that scene until we felt we had something that was complete.
Yeah, okay. So that's something you're comfortable with as a director?
It's easy for me. Like, all I do is you know, step away and let these incredible actors do what they know how to do really well. And I think that, you know, it's one of the smartest things that a director can do is know when to just take a back seat and not necessarily have to be in complete control all the time, and if you let your actors take control, you can oftentimes, you know, find something pretty inspired, and they make you look good.
Yeah. One issue I wanted to discuss with you is the problem with illegal downloading and piracy.
Sure.
I don't know if you know this, but your film was a bit available for illegal download several weeks before the premiere here at Stockholm. Due to the release on DVD and Blu-ray in the States. This, of course, affects the economical winnings of the movie. But I wanted to ask you how much this hurts your artistic integrity.
Well, I mean, it doesn't hurt. I mean, it's an interesting question. One is that I feel like we struggled with finding who the target audience for this movie was for a long time, and we finally found it, which is people who steal shit for free, and we're like, oh, this is who it was for, and you know, for me, it's very difficult for me to say that I'm angry about it or unequivocally against it, because, you know, while yes, it is illegal, and while yes, people worked very hard on this and didn't necessarily get paid any money at all. I haven't made a dollar off of this movie, and so, like, you're not necessarily taking out of my pocket because there's nothing in my pocket. I certainly feel like there is a certain level of awareness that was created globally for the film the minute that happened that didn't exist before that. So for me, when you look at the costs of advertising, when I see how much they spent just to put one commercial on The Tonight Show, and for however many people that we actually got to go to the theater there versus the absolutely, you know, free act of, I mean, it's free for us too. I have weird conspiracy theories that thing was leaked by the studio, because I feel like people, I mean, you know, I feel like people are starting to realize, one, that, you know, this is a, I don't even, it's not necessarily even a black market, because it's, you know, people are pretty blatant about the fact that they're doing it. I mean, I've seen tweets, you know, downloading Safety Not Guaranteed right now. Whoop,
well,
you know.
It creates a buzz. But it's
yeah, and you know, for me, like, my goal right now is to introduce myself to a global audience as a filmmaker and to create a fan base that will hopefully come and pay to see my movies that I make later in life. And so it's, unfortunately, like, I don't even know if my interests and the interests of the studio are aligned here. Because it's, in a lot of ways, it's just a benefit for me to, if you know, if people like the movie, yeah. You know, these are people that'll hopefully be an audience of mine in the future. Whereas, you know, if the studio needs them to pay for this movie, yeah. You know, whereas I have a little bit more flexibility.
All
right. That's, first of all, I'm not saying go download the movie for free. Like, let's be clear.
Download it, watch it, and then buy it.
Please, yeah, like, if there's any way that you can pay for it, like, I encourage you to do so.
Yeah, I recommend that as well. We, of course, must ask you a certain question about a galaxy far, far away.
Oh, boy.
There have been rumors that you've been talking with Lucasfilm and may or may not be one of the front runners to direct the new Star Wars movie.
Right.
What do you have to say about that?
I have very little to say about it. Certainly, like, no specifics about, you know, whatever is going on behind the scenes in the selection of that person. I think that I can speak as a Star Wars fan and what's important to me, which is that whoever does do this movie, I think it just needs to have a fundamental understanding of why it's important to us. And, you know, we come from a generation that grew up with this as children, and it's, you know, to us, it's almost a belief system, and it's harder for people who are older or who were already cynical when the movies came out, who are already teenagers, to understand how deeply it is our mythology. And there are a bunch of incredible directors who are up for this job, I think whoever gets it will have just that fundamental understanding of why Star Wars matters, and it matters so much to you know, a billion people. It's just incredible, and that's all I can say about it. But I would say I'm equally as excited about it as a fan and as someone who is still, like, you know, partially a child in a lot of ways as you know, anyone else. Yeah. That's all you're gonna get.
Cool. Do you have any other planned projects or something?
Yeah, definitely. There's a movie that we hope to shoot in the summer that Derek and I wrote that I like very much, called Intelligent Life. And there have been a couple other things we're writing for various studios. There are just a lot of really cool opportunities that have come along as a result of this. You know, it's not something that it wasn't necessarily a results oriented act, you know, making this movie. Like, we did want the result to be that we got to make something that was tangible that we could actually see. But beyond that, we didn't really calculate, like, what it would necessarily mean career wise, and to have it have such an incredible result, and the opportunities that exist for both Derek and I to continue to be creative for well into the future is beyond anything we could have expected. So it's very cool.
Yeah, nice. Victor, do you have any questions? I ran out of questions.
I'm just wondering, kind of to continue on this piracy thing, if you think that the people watching the movie via piracy, mm-hmm. That it's kind of, if piracy weren't existing, how should I put this? Those who watch it, some of them go and buy the movie. They're like, we want to support this movie, and so we'll buy a copy of it, or we'll go to the cinema and watch it, and to have these people make more movies. And do you think that when it's available on like the Pirate Bay or things like that income from those people that is greater than if it weren't existing at all? That if the only option was the theater. I'm thinking, how many of those would go to the theater really to kind of give it the first chance?
Well, so, it's impossible to know.
Yeah.
But I also, you know, in the case of our film, you know, if you want to, if you live in Sweden and you want to buy this movie, it's not available to you.
No, U.S. import is
yeah, like the U.S. import is the only
without the Swedish subtitles. That's the
right. Yeah, yeah, they didn't do a Blu-ray that has subtitles all around the world. So there's a lot of countries that really have no option but to download it for free, and that's kind of on us. I feel like for the studio to have made a decision to not put the subtitles on, I understand, because they were focused solely, you know, Sony did our U.S. distribution, and that's what they were focused on, and so it's almost like they're just giving it away if they put, you know, Chinese subtitles on it. But, you know, it's a tough scenario, and I personally just wish that the people who did pirate the movie and wanted to support it would at least have the option to do that.
Yeah.
And in this case, they don't.
Because it's not available on VOD or something like that either, no.
And you know, also iTunes, you can't get it on iTunes here. And so, like, in America, there's 15 different ways you can get it. So if you pirate in America, you can suck it. but, like, I have no sympathy for you. It's $4.99. It's on iTunes. Just deal with it.
Yeah.
But, you know, around the world, that's not the case. And so I feel like, it, to a certain extent, and that's actually very unique with our film. In most cases, you know, you can get it, but in our scenario, you know, look, I mean, there's a part of me that is, you know, I think it's kind of cool that, you know, that we've made something that a very discerning crowd, being, you know, a younger generation who is getting a lot of their entertainment online, has attached to. And that is the target audience. That's who I want to reach. That's who I feel like I'm here to entertain over the long haul. So, you know, the bottom line is that, you know, I'm trying to create a coalition of people, of young people who are interested in seeing the stories that I want to tell. And so it's hard for me to get that angry about it, because my goal is being accomplished here.
Yeah.
I know it's very selfish, and I'm not, you know, I'm sure the studio, I'm going to get a call from the studios. Seriously, man. But, you know, that's kind of where I'm at.
Yeah. And I'm also wondering, last question, that there are those directors, like, because I'm interested in becoming a filmmaker as well. I don't know, I want to work behind the camera. I'm not really sure if I want to be a director or whatever, but I would like to work someday at least behind the camera in some way. And I'm wondering, the way into the movie business, that is kind of, it's getting smaller and smaller, it seems like. And there are directors like David Fincher who say, they say that don't go to film school, like make movies, make shorts and post them on YouTube and etc. And then there are the other group that says go to film school, that's the perfect way into the movie business. Like, I think Rian Johnson is one of those that kind of likes the film school way into the movie business. So I'm wondering, where do you end up on that kind of scale? Is it... How do you feel, which is the best way, like, for if I were to become a filmmaker, how would I go about it? How would I do?
You know, I think the real answer is that it depends on the person.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, I personally support film school because it's where you meet your collaborators, and I think that's a crucial part of learning what filmmaking is. It's a collaborative process, and, you know, if I hadn't gone to film school, I wouldn't know Derek Connolly. You wouldn't have this movie. So I obviously have a very fundamental reason why it makes a lot of sense. It's also shockingly expensive, and I don't necessarily know that anything is worth, you know, $100,000 in debt over a lifetime, especially if you're going to be going into the arts. So it's hard, you know, and I know that's not the case in Europe. That's a very American-centric idea that school costs money, but it costs an extraordinary amount of money in America. And so it's hard for me to say, yeah, you know, pretty much mortgage your life on this thing that you're already gambling on. You know, a lot of people who decide to become filmmakers, pretty smart young men and women who probably could do a lot of different things with their lives and be successful at it, and they're choosing to place their bets on a you know, career that offers no guarantee of success whatsoever. And if anything, you know, almost a guarantee of a constant lifetime of reaching for that success. And you know, I talk to a lot of classes. I try to go to, you know, film school classes whenever I can, and I always feel like I sound like I'm overly negative in that I say, look, like, you know, I know some very successful screenwriters who, you know, a friend of mine wrote Children of Men and Iron Man. I mean, these are guys who are as successful as you can be, and they'll tell you that, and I'll tell you that there's always that feeling that you're going to be bankrupt in a year, no matter what. Like they always leave you reaching for it, and to get into that echelon where you're not worried about money anymore, you're starting to count those people on your hands to a certain extent. And so I think film, and that wasn't necessarily the case in the 90s. In the 90s, you'd go out and sell a spec script for $1 million, and you know, we're set up, and that's not the case anymore. And so I think there's some good things about it. I know I'm rambling about this, but there's some good things about it, and that I think that now, like, it's almost more of an art than it used to be, and that you really have to commit to it as if, you know you're going to be a painter or somebody who doesn't. You're a bohemian all of a sudden if you decide to be a filmmaker now, and it's not necessarily a way to make crap tons of money. And I think if you're going into it to make a lot of money, you like just go be a hedge fund guy. You're joining the wrong business. But also for me, you know, it's exciting to see. I think this year, if you just look at this year and last year alone, there are a lot of really cool independent films that are fresh and different, that, you know, they may not have made a fortune, but they all made their money back. And, you know, if that can at least continue to be supported, these movies that cost like $1 to $2 million, and ours was on the low end of that. There's Ava DuVernay, who's also here at this festival, made a movie for like $200,000 to $300,000.
Yeah.
The fact that you're able to make something that an audience will accept as being a motion picture for that amount of money, I think, actually opens the doors to a lot more people. So I feel like it's easier to make a film now than ever before in history, but it's harder to get rich making films now than ever before in history. Yeah. So it just depends on how much you want.
Yeah, to me it feels like kind of the extremely big movies, these kind of blockbuster movies, it's more and more of those, and more of those of the extremely small movies. The kind of the in-betweens, those movies is kind of fewer and fewer, I feel.
Well, that's it. I mean, you're noticing a very clear pattern that is the mandate of pretty much every studio, which is that, you know, a studio like Paramount or Disney used to make like 20 to 25 movies a year, and now they make like 7. Mm-hmm. And they'll make 7 movies that cost them $150 million each, you know, 100 to 150 to 200 sometimes. And they know, you know, look, like our movie made 5 times its budget. But its budget was, you know, it still made $4 million. Yeah. And so even if a movie, you know, like Men in Black 3, globally, you know, it cost them $200 million, but, you know, they bring in $500 million, and their profit is $100 million, like, that's just a better investment from a business standpoint than making, you know, whatever we made for people. So, you know, like, I understand it from a business standpoint, but what's really a bummer is that we've almost relied on independent film to provide anything below that mark, like anything below $100 million. Looper is an independent film. That's still a $30 million movie, but it's an independent movie. And so it seems like, you know, adult dramas, adult films in general, like anything rated R that isn't The Hangover or, you know, or Ted, both very funny movies, you know, that's pretty much become the provenance of independent distributors and financiers. And yet there's a weird benefit to it too, because they're willing to take risks on younger directors and first time directors. And I think another weird pattern that I've seen, we were kind of discussing a version of it, is directors who've made, you know, one or two small films, and then they get Thor, or they get Spider-Man, or, you know, you know, I'm not against this.
Star Wars, come here.
I'm not saying against it, but you know, I think what it is it's actually just a result of the polarization of budget, of the sizes of budgets, whereas like there's not even really anything in between those things anymore. So I don't even know if people have much of a choice. Like, you're either making a tiny movie or you're making a giant movie. But if you want to make something in between, like, you just, what is there, you know?
Yeah. Thank you, Colin, for this interview.
Yeah,
thank you very much.
I think we need to wrap this up.
Yeah.
So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great. Could we take some pictures? Sure.